This tour is part of the Ashford Place Generations of Learning project, a lottery-funded project that aims to capture, celebrate and learn from the history, heritage and experience of Cricklewood's Irish and Pakistani immigrant communities. Over a period of 8 months, we've collected some truly inspirational stories from people who came to Northwest London in the 1950s and 60s from Pakistan and Ireland. I'll be sharing some of these at various locations around the area. This tour will last approximately 2.5 hours. Before we start walking towards our first stop, I'd like to share a bit about the context of migration in the area. Both Pakistan and Ireland share history with Britain going back hundreds of years. Both had formed parts of the British Empire. In Pakistan, rapid industrialisation and agricultural improvements in the 1950s and 1960s couldn't keep pace with population growth, and poverty was widespread in rural areas. Like Ireland, the economy was largely agricultural. There were added difficulties for the millions of Muslims who migrated from India and found themselves in shanty towns focused on large cities. In Ireland, the loss of the industrialised north significantly impacted the economy, and the large agricultural republic suffered economic depression into the 1950s and 1960s. This was accompanied by population growth. Hundreds of thousands left to find work in other countries. Many came to the UK, particularly in the years after the end of World War II in 1945, when the UK needed help to rebuild. Like Pakistan, many Irish had supported Britain, serving in the armed forces and working in munitions factories in both World War I and World War II. In both Ireland and Pakistan, in the post-war period, British organisations ran active recruitment campaigns. There were labour shortages in Britain as the nation experienced an economic boom, initiated nationwide reconstruction projects and needed workers. Britain still had a strong manufacturing base and exported widely to colonial and post-colonial nations around the world. In Brent, the post-war boom meant light industry and factories stretched along the length of the A5, from Cricklewood to Neasden, Hendon and Staples Corner. Companies competed to attract workers, advertising a range of services. Often, young, single people came to Britain from Ireland and Pakistan and sent money home to support large families. Culturally, both countries shared similar outlooks, including the importance of family, strong religious identity, and hard work ethic. Right now, we're standing outside Willesden Green Station. Try to imagine what the area looked like in the late 50s and early 60s. Willesden Borough suffered severe bomb damage during the Second World War because of the concentration of industry and railway lines. The area was in decline. Migrants played a significant role in rebuilding the economy and the area, as well as establishing and supporting their own communities. Now we'll walk down Station Parade towards our first stop. Here we are inside the Central Mosque of Brent, the first purpose-built mosque in North London. The light is streaming through the atrium ceiling. It's spacious and airy. Iridescent mosaics forming Quranic verses grace the panels on the ceiling. They're silver and blue in colour. There is a minbar, or a pulpit, adorned with beautiful blue and green Turkish Isnik tiles. The carpets are a light grey colour, with blue patterned lines marking out the lines for prayer. There are a handful of men with long red beards wearing green turbans sat on the floor reciting the Quran. The mosque is a Sufi mosque, mostly frequented by Pakistanis. It was built on land previously owned by Transport for London. The mosque was established in 1984. Muhammad Iqbal, chairman of the mosque committee, recalls it took 35 years to build. Before the mosque was built, people would pray in the Pakistani community centre for 10 years, and before that they would gather to pray in a house on Keys Road. I'll tell you a bit more about that when we visit the house. Muhammad Iqbal came to London in 1964, during a very cold winter. I remember this detail, as this was the same year my father came to London. He told me he spent the better part of his first 2 weeks under his duvets, feeling dubious as to whether he made a mistake in coming to the UK. Some of the elders expressed similar fears upon arriving in London, but there was no going back, at least not in the near future. Muhammad Iqbal started work as a freight clerk for British Rail at Willesden Green before moving to Stonebridge Park Freight Yard for 22 years. He then ran a shop on Kilburn High Road, later opening a fish and chip shop. He moved into letting properties before retiring. Muhammad Iqbal talked about how difficult it was to raise the money to build the mosque. They would go door to door to collect money from people in the community, and they would undertake collections during Friday prayers. They collected pound by pound, Muhammad exclaimed. People didn't have much, but they gave what they could till they could finally have enough to build the mosque. The elders take a lot of pride in looking after the mosque they worked so hard to create. Many have now retired, and in their old age spend a lot of their time frequenting the mosque for their 5 daily prayers. People often tend to become more inward-looking and spiritual in old age. As well as being a religious space, the mosque is also a community space, a space where elders can meet and chat with their friends. In a time when it's easy, especially if you're older, to become socially isolated, spaces like this are even more important. Elders talk about their visits back home, politics in Pakistan. They find out how others in their community are doing. Often, elders meet at the mosque before going to a hospital together to see a friend who's sick, or going to a funeral. It's also a place where the prayers take place after someone passes away. Their bodies are washed and covered in the mosque, and people can pay their final respects to the one who has passed. Many of the early migrants have slowed down in retirement, and their connection to the mosque is now stronger than it's ever been. When Pakistanis first came, many didn't expect to stay long. Their main aim was to save money and go back home. My dad came to London in 1964. He was always a bit of an explorer. He used to work for the Pakistani Railways and would love going on adventures. And what greater adventure than taking up an opportunity to go to London? He received an invitation he couldn't refuse. He came from a very poor family. My grandfather and uncles all worked on a farm for a very miserly landowner. My dad was the only one of his 8 brothers who went to school, let alone university. He also wanted to work hard to save money that he could then send back to his parents. In the popular imagination of people from Commonwealth countries, England was a place where the streets were paved in gold, the land of milk and honey. The reality was so different from the idea that people had, and it was so difficult to adjust. But people settle and time passes, and before you know it, you've ended up staying a lifetime. Before the mosque and the PCC were established, people often gathered at one another's houses. They'd spend a lot of time at their free time seeing the sights of London. They would often go to the cinema, including the State Cinema in Kilburn, which often showed Indian and Pakistani films and newsreels. Tariq Dar, a local councillor whose father was involved in the establishment of the mosque, recalls going to watch a wrestling team visiting Wembley from Pakistan. He came over to London when he was a boy, and he recalled living in a house with a very large extended family. He'd often have to make 11 cups of tea. People would also spend their free time playing cards and reading the newspaper. The mosque is such an important resource in the community. There's also a hall under the mosque and classrooms where children gather to learn the Quran. Muhammad Iqbal emphasizes the need to educate young people about Islam and their religious and cultural identity, which he fears might be eroding as a result of growing up in the West. He stresses the importance of remembering who you are and where you're from. He also emphasizes how important it is for younger generations to recognize the struggles the elders went through so they can enjoy freedoms such as praying in the mosque. We're now standing outside the Pakistani Community Centre, or the PCC. It's a small yellow building next to the mosque. Beside it, an ice cream van is parked up. The doors are open and there are a few people inside. The Pakistani Community Centre began in 1965 as the Pakistan Workers Association to help the newly arrived migrant workforce from the subcontinent with jobs, housing and other social needs. Tariq Dar talked a lot about how people would help one another in many ways, whether that was filling in official forms or helping people to find a place to live. People saved money to buy their own homes. Back then, it was seen as shameful to rely on the council for help, and often Pakistanis would help each other by offering interest-free loans so they could all progress at the same time. Nowadays, the PCC has evolved into a community force, given its pivotal support to the local matters, including the participation in the homeless project, along with churches and other bodies providing shelter and food to those most disadvantaged in society. It also works avidly in various charitable schemes, in partnership with the Metropolitan Police, Brent Council, Brent Voluntary Sector, resident associations, and other voluntary organisations. to assist in the safety and protection of the community. The PCC also conducts voluntary work on a daily basis, such as language teaching, engaging with the youth and the elderly to ensure the betterment of the community as a whole. Before the establishment of this building, meetings were held in different places, with people collecting donations to host events on Pakistan Day. The aim of the event was to bring people together to enjoy themselves. The elders have stressed how important it is for the younger people to know what the events meant to them. It was a way of connecting them to each other and to their homelands, to feel a sense of pride and belonging to both worlds. One elder reflected on the use of the community centre for music, with people from other faiths joining events. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, a famous folk singer, once played at the centre. There was a queue going all the way down the road, and a lot of English people also attended. Pakistani culture is incredibly rich in music and poetry and storytelling. Pakistanis take real pride in their culture, as do the Irish. Simultaneously, in the Galtymore Dance Hall on the other side of Cricklewood, young Irish men and women came together to dance, to socialise, and often you'd have musicians coming from Ireland to play. It was a way of uniting. Every Wednesday, a Pakistani women's group comes together to recite the Quran, socialise, and enjoy a Pakistani lunch. Everyone brings a dish. I remember the first time I visited, I was a bit worried. I wasn't sure what they would make of me. A Pakistani woman in my late 20s, single, a tour guide. I know Pakistani aunties can be very critical, and I was silently praying that they would be nice. When I went in, there was a big group of women sat around a table. They were all smiling and welcomed me warmly. One lady called me over to sit next to her. We got talking. Her name was Rizia, but I called her Auntie Rizia out of respect. She told me her story. Soon after she lost her parents, she followed her husband to England, who was working here as an engineer. 10 years ago, he unexpectedly passed away, and a few years ago she lost her beloved son and business partner, aged 25, in a car accident. Despite her loss, Auntie Rizia radiated warmth, positivity and faith, as did everyone at the centre. She explained to me that the group was her family now. They took care of one another and loved each other greatly. While the proximity of Ireland meant home was much closer and many Irish regularly returned to visit friends and family, families in Pakistan were often separated for years at a time, so there was perhaps more of a need for Pakistanis to really come together. Another story that really resonated with me was the story of Mrs. Qureshi, known to many as the Pakistani Mother Teresa in the area of Willesden. Mrs. Qureshi worked as a teacher in a convent school in Pakistan before she married and came to London to join her husband. She had a very busy and very fulfilling life in Pakistan. She was loved and respected by the students and by the nuns at the school. She felt very isolated when she came to England. She got pregnant quite early on and spent much of her time at home with her sister, who had already settled in the country with her husband. After some years in London, Mrs. Qureshi fell pregnant with her second child. She and her husband decided to move back to Pakistan. A few years after they did, her husband died unexpectedly. She decided to move back to London to be with her sister, and because her heart was no longer in Pakistan, she built a life for herself and for her children. She ended up fostering children in the area, non-Pakistani children, and helped them to study and to get a head start in school, as many of them had felt fallen behind. She also runs weekly Quran classes for Pakistani women and supports teenagers undertaking Urdu GCSEs and A-levels. Mrs. Qureshi emphasised throughout the interview the importance of holding on to your identity and keeping a connection to your homeland. She talked about London being a very open place, a place where you can have mixed identities, a place where you can be whoever you want to be. One thing that really struck me about these stories were the strength and kindness the women possessed, and the love for their families and for their communities, and their commitment to service. Irish women are similar in a sense. Many Irish women worked as nurses in the UK, helping others. They had a very caring attitude. They were equally committed to their families and to their communities, and they contributed so much to society, both within their communities and outside of them. All of them, all the while retaining a sense of self and identity to the country they migrated from. Something to think about now as we wander over to our next stop. Right now, we're standing outside 44 Keys Road, a house bought by the community and converted into a mosque. Soon after the property was purchased, problems occurred. As it was in a residential area, the constant noise and movement of people in and out meant that they needed to leave. The council was involved in finding a new site for the mosque. Tariq Dar mentions Mrs. Hooper at Brent Council. She was influential in assisting the development of the community centre as a temporary mosque while funds were being raised to buy the neighbouring land. During the last tour, a man came out of his house. It was the house next door to 44 Keys Road. He was curious about what we were doing and asked us. I told him about the Generations of Learning Heritage Project and that the house was the first mosque in the area. He then went on to recall worshippers coming in and out of the house in the 80s and reaffirm the facts I'd strung together from what I'd heard from the elders. Let's stop outside here for a moment. Behind me is a white painted building, the Cricklewood Lodge Hotel. When I was doing the recce for the tour a few months ago, I couldn't figure out where the Galtymore Dance Hall used to be. The spot on my map just didn't look right. I knocked on the door of the hotel. It was locked and no one answered. I started walking down the street, and then a man came rushing behind me and asked in a very strong Irish accent if there was anything he could help with. I told him I was looking for the spot where the Galtymore Dance Hall used to be. He told me he didn't know where it was, but then he told me that he would take me to a woman who would, at the local pub. Outside the pub, there were two elders sat drinking. The man from the hotel knew them and asked if they knew where the Galtymore was. They, of course, did. They told me it was directly opposite the bingo hall, but there was nothing there anymore, just disused land covered by a billboard. I asked if I could join them and have a chat, curious to learn more. They warmly offered a seat next to them, and a man from the hotel asked if I wanted anything, a juice or a coke or anything. I refused, but was taken by his kindness. Soon I got chatting to the elders, Jerry and John. Jerry told me his story. He was a carpenter. He met his wife in Ireland when they were both 15. She was a nurse. They had been together for over 50 years. His son was also a carpenter and married to an Irish girl. He talked about how different life was then, tough, but also better in many ways. People came together, they worked hard, and they would go to the dance hall. He told me a lot of Irish people met their partners at the Galtymore. People had more time then to socialise. His sentiments were something that the Pakistani community also affirmed. People were more connected. They weren't so busy. They had more time to come together because there were fewer of them. Nowadays, the Pakistanis have settled. They've had kids and grandkids. They have big families and they don't have as much time to socialise. John talked about the Crown Pub, the place that was the next stop on the tour. He had great memories of staying there late, having fun, getting into fights. He talks about the workers having to wait around for hours to get their day's wages. The police were always parked up at the front awaiting violence. In the 1970s, increased violence in the north of Ireland and IRA bombing campaigns in England created anti-Irish feeling, similar to the anti-Muslim Pakistani feeling in response to violent extremism. The Irish were often targeted outside pubs. There were always brawls and arrests. The fact that the Irish had no other choice but to wait around in the pubs also fed into the stereotype of the Irish constantly drinking and behaving disorderly. It was another way of dehumanising them. After a while, I said goodbye to John and Jerry. They wished me the best and I started walking towards the direction of the Galtymore. The nice thing about working on this tour and the project is the way it's been brought to life by real life, almost serendipitous encounters. Often, wandering around the area, I'd meet someone with memories to share, and these memories are for me what would bring history to life in a very beautiful and real way. It's the small details. I remember one Pakistani elder telling me of a memory she once had of throwing away an ice cream cone in a bin after finishing the ice cream. She didn't know that you could eat the cone. After all these years, she still remembers that, and that really struck me. We'll now go over to our next stop, the Crown. For much of the 20th century, the Crown was famous for being at the heart of London's Irish community, which flourished around Cricklewood and Kilburn. Early each morning, groups of Irish tradesmen and labourers would gather in the forecourt of the Crown for the call-on, the process in which local building contractors would turn up with trucks and vans to recruit a number of men out of the crowd for a day's casual labour. From the late 1960s, early 70s, the subcontractors often sent workers to the Crown at the end of the day to pick up their wages. Cheques were then cashed in the pub. Sometimes they'd have to wait around for the wages to arrive, adding to the perceived problem with drinking. The days of the Crown being a spit and sawdust pub where local workers were drafted have now long faded. Today, the pub has been gentrified. Daniel Foley, one of the elders we talked to, talked about the regular talent contest, remembering Jack McCarthy from Waterville Co. Kerry as a winner who founded the band Dingle Spike. Rosemary, Daniel's wife, recalls Irish men not being allowed into their rooms until late evening, so having to stay out socialising in pubs until they were allowed in by their landlords, which again added to the perception of the Irish being in the pubs all the time. Daniel recalls that most young Irish didn't drink much. They were coming from rural areas, but now they had nowhere else to socialise. Again, police and institutional racism was a problem, profiling Irish people and targeting them outside known Irish pubs, notably the Crown. I dug up a few memories online that I'd like to share. This one is from Anthony John Mooney. I remember in 82 as an 18-year-old standing outside the Crown early morning in the cold, hoping for a start. I really got one, as I was too skinny and not old enough. Or I spoke with a London accent despite having an Irish dad. I was plastic. On the rare occasion I got one, they made sure I earned my money. Boy, it was hard graft then, back in the dirty van, smelly, back to the Crown to spend the day's wages, first at the numerous cafes for dinner, for some great home cooking. Bet they're all gone now. Then over the road, a few light and bitters, kicked out drunk at 11, back to the bedsit, hoping to wake in time for another day work. The weekends were great in the Crown, then on to the Galtee Moor, or venture into Kilburn, Willesden or Neasden, with more of a choice of pubs. I'm sure in the early 80s the Crown was still the only pub there. My mate worked in the big fruit and veg stall outside. Great times back then. Boy, I'm feeling old. Pat says, often I drank in the Crown, had great old memories of drinking in the front bar. They called it the Cork and Kerry Bar. Then, when done, around the corner to the Galtee, or Ashton's next door. I often got on the 32 bus to Kilburn, to the Black Lion, McGovern's and the Kingdom. Was there from 86 to 91. Great times. Now I live in Ohio. We'll always have great memories of the Crown. For an Irishman, they say, you were never in England if you were never in the Crown. How true. Now let's make our way to the spot where the Galtee Moor Dance Hall used to be. Here we are outside the spot where the Galtee Moor used to be. There's nothing here anymore, but if you can imagine how big and culturally significant the dance hall was. The Galtee Moor opened in 1952. People from all over London would come to the dance hall. The venue hosted many big nights. The biggest was the night Larry Cunningham played there in the early 1967. Though still working as a full-time builder, Cunningham had recorded hits on both sides of the Irish Sea in the previous year. A total of 6,850 paying customers saw Cunningham and his band, the Mighty Avons, that night in the Galtee Moor, a record. Many people of that generation met future spouses there. Daniel mentioned that one side of the dance hall was for traditional set dances, for example, Siege of Venice, with the other side for modern music, with big show bands. He also mentioned there was a roller skating rink next door, founded by Charles Claw. It was a place of music and dancing and laughter and life. In a way, the two communities were living similar, almost parallel lives in their own cultural microcosms, but they didn't interact very much. Tariq Dar mentions that business owners were much more likely to interact. He owned a shop at one point, where he sold Irish food and newspapers, and would often talk to the Irish people who came in. People read the newspapers to find out news from back home. Telephones were rare in rural Ireland, as they were in Pakistan. Most people communicated via letters. Much later, in the 90s, I remember you would have phone shops where you could make international phone calls. I remember going along with my mum. You'd have to wait around, and you wouldn't have much time to talk, as it was so expensive to use the phones. That's how people connected to family back home. That's often how you'd receive news about births and deaths. My mum talked about always feeling a sense of disconnection, physical and emotional, from both your homeland and your newly adopted country. Now everything has changed. Most people have mobile phones and you can make cheap calls. You can communicate more easily. Flights are cheaper. But when you think about it, how difficult it must have been then, the younger generation should feel a real sense of privilege. It's a blessing. We're now just outside where the Smiths factory used to be. Smiths hired over 8,000 people, including a large number of migrant Pakistani and Irish workers. Most employees were women. Many Irish and Pakistani women would work in factories back at the time. All my mum's friends had a job in the textile factories in the 70s. Back then it was very easy to get a job. There were so many factories. Often people would bring their friends to a factory and they'd get work the same day. Daniel Foley recalls that the factory left the area in the 1980s. Computerisation reduced the need for large workforce. Liaquat, another elder we interviewed, worked in a button factory in Kilburn alongside Indian, English, Pakistani and West Indian people. He recalls how happy he was to receive his first wages, around £7 and 2.5 shilling. There was integration between people from different backgrounds in the factories, but it was limited, owing to language barriers. Transport for London was one of the biggest employers of migrants in the 1960s, and there were many Irish and Pakistani bus drivers. Two of the elders we interviewed, Mohammed Altaf and Tom Ryan, remember working together. We're stood just inside Cricklewood Bus Garage. 800 bus drivers work out of this bus garage. Last week, Fiona gave us an introduction to the garage, including health and safety, followed by a tour from lovely Debbie. She showed us around the canteen. Jerk chicken was on the menu. The TV was playing in the background. She then let us have a quick peek in the locker room. There are pictures and flags from different countries on the lockers. One locker has a big sticker, on it, 100% Irish, and with a postcard stuck below, a black and white, on it a skeleton and the words printed, waiting for a bus in Ireland. In the games room, a group of Jamaican bus drivers were playing dominoes. We're mistaken for trainee bus drivers upstairs by the men in the office. They track where the buses are going and inform the bus drivers to wait at the bus stop if they're ahead of schedule. Afterwards, Debbie lets us onto a bus, and some of us got a chance to sit in the bus driver's seat. Fiona mentioned that everything has changed now. The union isn't very strong, and communities often segregate themselves. It's not as close-knit as it used to be. She remembers Mohammed Altaf. Mohammed moved from Blackburn to Cricklewood in 1971, when he started working for London Transport. Mohammed worked as a conductor for a year before becoming a driver. He worked out of Cricklewood Bus Garage for many years until retiring in 2010 due to ill health. He grew up in Jhelum. He discusses the original perceptions. It was very cold when he first came to London, and he recalled burning cola and using paraffin heaters. He notes that London has changed over the last 50 years. He goes back to spend several months in Pakistan regularly now that he's retired. This is something that many of the elders do. He worked with many Irish at Cricklewood. He remembers many Irish on the bus, always singing songs. He sees some of his former Irish colleagues, but notes that many of them went back home or passed on. He discusses the 245, 16, 32 and 266 bus routes. He recalls that many black people used the 266, the Irish were on the 32 and the 16, and the 245 was mixed, reflecting where people were living and working in their communities. The English people on the 16 bus were much more likely to complain. He remembers finding the Irish people very nice and friendly. He worked on the buses for 40 years. He spoke to us about the good old days and how they were gone now. There was more freedom, but now the cameras on the buses make the drivers feel as though they're being watched at all times. He recalls the managers were friendly and the unions were strong in the past. He recalls the headquarter offices at Shepherd's Bush and Chiswick and notes that now there are lots of private firms focused mostly on saving money. London Transport provided better facilities for its staff. My dad also worked at TfL for many years as a booking clerk at Kennington Underground Station. He spoke a lot about the benefits of working for TfL then too, including receiving commission on weekly travel cards he sold. The bus garage is a lively and colourful place filled with laughter and friendship. It's not so hard to think about what it used to be like in the 60s. Here we are at our last stop on the tour, Gladstone Park. We're just inside the walled garden. It's a beautiful garden filled with all sorts of colourful flowers and plants. Parks are vital open spaces that are valued by every community. Gladstone Park was a place where everyone would visit. They would bring their kids to play in the park and to enjoy a picnic. Liaquat recalled memories of playing football and cricket in Gladstone Park. He describes how his father wanted to move to Luton, but he wanted to stay in Cricklewood, so they moved to Ivy Road near Gladstone Park. He recalls that people often used to have barbecues and go to the fun fair. He recalls the swimming pools in Gladstone Park and the beautiful view at the top of the hill. He's moved to Kingsbury now after getting married. He's lived there for 35 years. He moved partly because the houses in Cricklewood were so expensive. Another lady we interviewed, Jamila, came to Cricklewood from Pakistan aged 9. It was a big change for her. She lived in a village in the countryside where she had a lot of space and freedom. Many Irish and Pakistani migrants came from rural areas. They had always been connected to the land. Jamila mentioned going to Welsh Harp Reservoir when she felt homesick, as it reminded her of home. She attended a school in Neasden, and her children and grandchildren now attend. She remembers walking to and from school on her own. She recalls there was more freedom then than there is today. In Pakistan, they would often go to the shops by horse and cart, and here in London, they'd go by bus. Everything was different. This park is a lively community space, still frequented by Pakistanis and Irish, and also newer migrant communities, including North Africans and Brazilians. London is constantly changing. People are constantly moving, and stories are constantly evolving. As part of this tour, I've only managed to share a few stories, but hopefully it will give you an idea of the kind of life Irish and Pakistani migrants lived when they first arrived in London, the hardships they faced, and the ways in which they've contributed to their communities as well as society on a whole. This tour was created by Sara Niazi for Ashford Place as part of a Generations of Learning project. Thank you.